Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
And now you just might call this story Jack the Ripper versus an army of digital Sherlock Holmeses set in the 21st century. A killer on the loose in the Boston area back in 2009 was targeting women who advertised to meet men on Craigslist. He left behind a trail of bodies, but nothing in the way of physical evidence linking the murderer to his crimes. It was the death of troubled college student, though, Jalissa Brissman in a high school or a high-rise hotel in Boston that turned this bloody mystery into a set of leads that led to a full-scale 21st century criminal investigation. The solving of the case and the identification of suspect Philip Markoff, a.k.a. the Craigslist killer, was a painstaking, unusual investigation through a digital world of false identities, IP addresses, a collision of the identities some people take on when they enter social media and the identities other people try to shed when they log in. Freelance journalist James Robinson recounts the police investigation in Hunting the Craigslist Killer. It's the title of a recent article he wrote for the Boston Phoenix. James joins us from the Boston studios of our partner station, WGBH. Welcome to the program, James.
Hi there, John.
This is an amazing story about people, but it's also a story about the emergence of digital forensics. Tell me about the people first.
Well, I think on that side, I mean, the detectives, you know, who work on this stuff, you know, the whole time, and I think it really presented a very sort of interesting new case for them of these new techniques that they use. So they are sort of the very tireless people who are working on this all the time. And then, you know, you have some very fascinating people with Philip Markoff himself, who is a very sort of conflicted and interesting character, a med student, but also, you know, really struggling with some dark gambling impulses and dark internet habits.
Both of the individuals in this case, at least the two individuals that broke the case finally, Jalissa Brissman, the victim, murder victim in Boston, and Philip Markoff, are people who are filled with demons, filled with compulsions, and suddenly the opportunity to shed your identity and enter a place where you can be completely hidden was an overwhelming temptation for both of them.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think what this story really presents is sort of a really interesting kind of model for this new digital age we live in, is while they had shared, you know, some of their identities, in the end, you know, there were all these digital breadcrumbs that really led back to who they really were. So that process of shedding who you are, it's really only goes so far.
And in fact, they thought they were completely safe in shedding their identities, both of them. But the legacy of this investigation and others like it means that no one ever again will feel so safe. Tell me about the digital forensics and the trail that began to, certainly underscore Philip Markoff as the chief suspect and then as the individual who was arrested. And, of course, he committed suicide in prison, so there's no closure in this case. But tell us about the forensics that led to him.
Well, Philip Markoff, he had signed up for an email address that he corresponded with Jalissa Brissman, and he'd signed up for that under a fake name. And so, you know, that really seemed like it kind of gave him a sense that he was anonymous when he had signed up for that email address from his own apartment. So his IP address was attached to the email, and he'd bought track phones over the counter from Targets and that he'd used to correspond with his victims. And what's, I think, a lot of people wouldn't be aware of is that, you know, wherever you go with your phone is bouncing back a signal from cell towers. So through the cell towers and the IP addresses, they really started to develop this geographic sort of idea of that he lived in the Quincy region, and they really started to drill down on him.
And how much of this information was completely available to the police through means that didn't require warrants, and how much of it required something on the order of, say, a wiretap to actually get access to certain files of people's digital identity?
Well, the police there were subpoenas that were filed, and so they had to go through all of the legal avenues, especially to go from having an IP address. You know, anyone can find the location of an IP address, but to find the user of an IP address, you know, you have to file the requisite legal paperwork for that. So they had an advantage on that. But when they had found him and he didn't have a record, he lived out of state, that's when they turned to Facebook and these other social media avenues to really flesh out their profile of who he was.
In the end, was his consistent attempt to hide his tracks and to conceal his identity what did him in the sense that it created a mountain of evidence that here was a guy trying to live underneath the radar?
It's one of the very interesting sort of conflicts and contrasts of this story is that it sort of gave him the impression that he was under the radar when all of the actual physical evidence, he had made no attempts to conceal. So detectives were just confounded that when they'd followed these digital forensics back to his apartment, I mean, he had made no attempt to hide the gun. Mm. He hadn't. There was blood on the weapon. He had blood on his shoes, inside his jacket. So it sort of seemed to create this incredible laziness in him to cover up the physical tracks that he had sewn.
What did the investigators say about the various interrogations that were made when Philip Markov was apprehended and questioned at certain times, and how he steadfastly tried to deny that there was anything to any of this?
Well, they sort of talked about he had this very sort of stoic poker face almost, that he didn't give anything away and he didn't seem bothered and he didn't seem upset. He was very, they all commented on how amazingly relaxed and even-handed he was, which, you know, is part of the contrast and conflicts of who he was with his suicide and how we'll never really get to reconcile, you know, what drove him to that point.
Do investigators believe that this online world encourages a kind of a digitally induced sociopath behavior where you can beat lie detectors and beat traditional sort of forensics that might tip people off?
Well, I mean, from my experiences and interactions with the investigators on this case, I mean, they're not too prone to sort of overthinking it, but I think they're really aware of this new toolbox of investigation that they have to sort of look at these digital tools and these IP addresses and email footprints. I think they're very aware that, not that it's a tool for someone to get away with more things, but that it's a tool for them to find people in these new ways.
Describe how revolutionary Facebook was before we go, because in a sense, the digital IP addresses, those sorts of things, are just simply links in a chain. But all of a sudden, when you have bodies of evidence on Facebook, you can start to think about motive. You can put together an actual psychological profile.
Well, it's important to note that in this case, they turned to Facebook once they had an idea of who the suspect was. But, I mean, maybe 20 years ago, they would have had nothing to go on, and it depends on, you know, back then it would have been a police record and what they could find in the paperwork. But as soon as they had a suspect's name, they turned to Facebook, and then immediately you have, you know, that he's engaged, you know, the schools that he's been to, you've got a profile of his friends. So we share all this information voluntarily about ourselves that just wasn't out there, you know, even 10 years ago.
So in a sense, as confident criminals might feel to being hidden and anonymous in this digital world, in fact, compared to a century ago, this entire digital fingerprint of all of our identities makes criminal investigation much easier, not harder.
And in a sense, I guess, I mean, if someone was aware of these things, they could beat it. But no, it has made things easier, I think.
James Robinson, freelance journalist and author of Hunting the Craigslist Killer. It's an article in the Boston Phoenix about the digital forensics and the extraordinary chain of events that led to the apprehension and identification of Philip Markov, the killer of Jalissa Brisman, the so-called Craigslist Killer. Thanks so much, James.
Thanks, John.